I'll talk briefly actually about myself, because I pick up on the theme of today and what I do, and it kind of leads into my talk about my book, and then I'll give a brief talk on my book, my latest book, which, contrary to what it says in the paperwork, though, was actually published in October 2010, not September 2011. So it's around, and I think there's a few in the bookshop available if anybody wants to buy one. I don't know if some of you might have been here with Joe Hemmings talking before. And it's interesting how, in a way, how quite similar our portfolio careers are, and how, you know, I would not have envisaged when I was at Warwick the way that my career kind of turned out. I mean, I like her, I'm a freelance, I specialise in a subject, I use the social media, I appear quite regularly on TV and radio, and I think there's quite a lot of people who have kind of developed careers like that, and how, in a way, actually, it's the future. I also use Twitter very, very intensely, and I must say that was quite a surprise that I started using Twitter, because I thought it was a terrible idea at first. So 140 characters, and, you know, what can you say in 140 characters, and so on. But actually, Twitter is the I think the medium out of this, that one of these things that's going to be here to stay, although you can never quite predict that. But it's much better than Facebook as a communication tool, because of its simplicity, because in 140 characters you can link to lots of other articles or stuff on the web. It allows you to communicate with those people who are directly interested in what you have to say. So, I mean, she said she'd got 11,000 followers. I've only been doing it for a few months, and I've got nearly a couple of thousand followers, and they're the people who are most likely to be interested in the work that I do. And so there is also quite an interactive side to it, in that they will respond to things, and you can respond back to them, you can ask questions of them, and so on. And I suspect Twitter will become, in a way, a kind of far more useful tool than Facebook. Anyway, to my book. Or a bit about my career. I mean, as was said, I'm a journalist, and actually proud of that. I know journalism has a totally bad reputation, but I'm actually proud of the journalistic skills I have. And I wrote a few books on policy, mainly rail policy. Although I also wrote a book about the abuse scandals in children's homes, and they didn't sell very much, and then I hit upon commercial books and wrote History of the London Underground, which is called Subterranean Railway, and that was quite successful. And then I wrote a book about the history of Britain's railways, which, amazingly enough, nobody had written a kind of concise history of Britain's railways, although there's 30,000 books on railways listed, and nobody just thought of, let's sit down and write a simple history of Britain's railways, which shows that there is often kind of niches available. And then I wrote a book about the world's railways and how they transformed the world. And then I've written this one, and I'm currently halfway through a book on the United States railways, and then I'm commissioned to write another two after that. So I'm kept busy until well beyond notional retirement age, but still, I find the whole idea of retirement completely boring, and I'm really not going to do that unless ill health makes me. What I try to do in these books really is, so many railway books are about a rather nerdish kind of obsession with technical aspects and, you know, train number aspects and all sorts of kind of things that I don't think are very interesting. Whereas what's really interesting about the railways is that they were the harbingers of the Industrial Revolution. They brought the Industrial Revolution, they spread the results of the Industrial Revolution around the, you know, Britain initially and then the world. They changed the way people's lives were lived, And that's kind of been forgotten. You know, we talk about the internet, or we talk about the telephone, or we talk about all sorts of other technical inventions, but actually the railway kind of came before those, and was actually more important. But yeah, that's the case I make in my books anyway. And the latest book I've written is actually seeks to change the way that people perceive war, and emphasise the role that the railways played in war, which I think has sort of been written out of much military history. I'm not a military historian. I lay some claim now to being a railway historian, but I'm not really an academic, but I read an awful lot of books to write my books, so I don't know if that counts as being an academic. But I have no claims to military expertise, but nevertheless, I've sort of written this book, and no military historian has actually laid into me and said, no, you're completely wrong. And quite a few have supported me, so my theory must be somewhat right. So I will give a quick rendition of the book. And that is the classic view of trains in warfare. The wives waving goodbye to the soldiers who go off to the front. And a lot of the books limit, military books limit the coverage to that, but actually it's a much more interesting story. And it's best illustrated by a contrast between two wars. That's the Battle of Waterloo. The Battle of Waterloo was actually over in a single day. Killed about 10,000 people in that day. But the logistics of the Battle of Waterloo, which was 1815, was determined by these things, the horses. And it's very interesting that warfare, until you got the railways, was really a matter of a battle, possibly a siege, which was easier to maintain, but a battle that maybe lasted a day or two, and then kind of a period of regrouping and peace and whatever, and then another battle. And so when we talk about the Hundred Years' War, it was nothing like, it was the odd battle in the space of 100 years, over the same issues. But it wasn't, it was not a continuous kind of war over that period. But contrast that with the Battle of Verdun, which lasted for most of 1916, from February to December, killed far more people than the Battle of Waterloo, probably 10 times that number, was sustained thanks to the fact of the logistics of the railways, that you could actually maintain this front that lasted for so long. So, and it was this invention, the railways. I give this talk a lot, and I just have one picture of a train, because often there's train spotters who like it, and actually that belongs to the Highland Railway, I was told, but I don't actually know, but I know it's just a nice picture of a train. And so briefly, I will just cover a few wars which I've looked at in the book. There's more in the book actually than I can possibly go through in a half an hour lecture. But the first instance of railways being used in warfare was the Crimean War. And the Crimean War, again, it should be famous for this actually, but it's not. It's famous for Florence Nightingale, and it's famous for the charge of the Light Brigade. But actually, the railway made a huge difference. And from the picture, you can see the siege took place at Sebastopol, which is kind of shown in this picture, a bit with artistic license, at the top of the hill there, and the port called Balaclava was at the bottom of the hill, and it was about 12 miles in between, and there was a great difficulty in getting between the two. Transport was very poor, and it was very muddy, and so on, and they hit upon the idea of building a railway between the two, and it was a very ramshackle railway, partly horse-drawn, as you can see, partly locomotive-drawn, built by navvies, Irish, largely Irish navvies, who were transported 3,000 miles from Britain to build this railway, did a fantastic job, built the railway, enabled the troops to then at the top of the hill to be supplied with the big guns, the shells, to have enough shells to fire to the Russians in Sebastopol, and broke the siege and actually finished the war very quickly. So it was the first historic instance of a railway being used in warfare, but it wasn't very integral to the whole operation, and it was not until the American Civil War that the use of railways really began to be understood. And the American Civil War is a fascinating war. It's just been the 150th anniversary of the start of the war. In studying it, actually, I mean, I was quite appalled at just what a bloody, nasty, horrible war it was. And most of there's a sort of in America, it's often kind of celebrated for all sorts of reasons, as you know, as a heroic war, and you know, as kind of not as significant as it was actually. And the most famous representation is the Buster Keaton film called The General, which is about a locomotive chase, which is why I mention it here, where a group of people, Yankees from the North, commandeered a locomotive while the engine driver was having breakfast and drove it 50, 60 miles, being chased by the engine driver and various other people. And it led to, there's been several films about it, but the General is the most famous one. But that was really insignificant in the wider scheme of things. And what was really significant about this war was the depth of the destruction that it caused. In the American Civil War, 600,000 soldiers died. And that is more soldiers, American soldiers, than in any and all their other wars put together. The Vietnam War, the First World War, the Second World War, various Spanish wars, all sorts of minor wars, didn't kill, all put together, 600,000 American soldiers. That was in a population that was then about 25 million. So you can see the sort of devastating circumstances that it had, and it was all down to the railways. The war was different in scale and conception and strategy than all previous wars. It was fought over an area the size of Europe. It was fought over 4 years. There were 400 events called battles, listed as battles. There were 10,000 events listed as conflicts of one sort or another. But that was a battle every 4 days for the space of 4 years. And these battles were sustained by the railway on both sides. The railway delivered people to the front. The battles took place over railway junctions. Railways were destroyed by one lot of troops and rebuilt by another lot of troops. There were instances. Locomotives were. This was an incident where a whole bunch of locomotives was actually lured into a town called Martinsburg and then kind of basically poached by the Confederates who nicked all those locomotives and so on. I mean, there was a whole huge series of battles that took place just around railway issues. As I said, the construction, destruction, reconstruction of railways played an absolute prominent role. And we had the first rail strategies, military rail strategies, was a guy called Hermann Haupt, who was a mathematician as well as an engineer, and had run railways before the war. And he was the first one to really understand the few basic things about the railways, and set down a few basic rules, such as You know, if you bring in a lot of suppliers on the railway, you take them off the coaches straight away, and you get rid of the coaches and wagons and take them back again. Very obvious, maybe, but actually a very important lesson. Because if you don't do that, you get supply chain blockages, and people start just using the railway as a storage point, and then you can't use it as a transport point, and so on. So very basic rules, but they took some time to understand. And in fact, in a lot of the wars that I cover in this talk, those basic rules were not actually properly understood. Haupt was famous, actually, for the most famous thing he did was rebuild this bridge. He built it in 9 days. Well, obviously with several thousand men, using local wood. I would not have gone on it myself, but President Lincoln visited the site and was amazed at how quickly the work could be done. And there's a lesson in this that throughout the story that I tell in the book, railways are kind of demolished and rebuilt with amazing haste. It's actually much easier to rebuild a railway, at least put some bit of track down temporarily, than one might think. And so the American Civil War was, in the history of the strategy of warfare, an absolutely key point. It was a turning point. And for the next 90-100 years, railways played a major role in every war. All the Spanish Civil War is an exception. I couldn't find much involvement in the Spanish Civil War, so I missed that out of my book. But virtually every war in where there were railways as well, the railway played an absolute key role. And in the Franco-Prussian War, which was really the precursor to the two First World Wars, to the two World Wars, because it was, again, France v Germany. The French lost, which is why they had this poster called The Damned, or the Bloody War. They lost because of their inability to deal with the railways. They didn't understand the importance of the railways. The Germans actually had signalled their intent by building their railways towards France, and so rather than, as in France, they had a kind of star shape out of Paris, the Germans kind of rather suspiciously built all their railways kind of like that, and like that towards Russia as well, which was possibly an indication of their intent. And they had huge stations on tiny branch lines kind of near the French border, far bigger than they needed, so it was pretty clear what they were up to. And the French, and I love this picture because it just shows what was wrong. The French kind of, had a really rather relaxed attitude towards the whole thing and didn't get their act together. And the war was declared, as wars always are, in the summer of 1870. Within 10 days, the Germans had all their troops at the front. And the French were busy kind of scurrying about the system, getting drunk, losing their regiments, not organising their trains properly, chatting, presumably, in this, as this poster says, about how to get there and so on, and never quite manage it. So it was the immediate contrast in the way they mobilised their troops that caused the problem. The war ended up being fought on French soil rather than German soil. The Germans very quickly kind of invaded Alsace and quickly headed off towards Paris, and the French really lost the war in the first few days. They did, as in all these wars, blow up the railway a few times, but really far too little and far too late. And the Germans actually made use of armoured trains, which was quite a very early use of them, and I will talk a little bit about that later. But they proved very useful in subsequent wars. Very quickly, the Sudan War was very interesting because it was a railway which won it. Sudan was as those of you with some knowledge of history remembered, the General Gordon and all his troops were massacred in Khartoum. British didn't do much about it until about 13 years later they decided to invade from Egypt, which was their colony, and they had to build a railway from the top, from Wadi Haifa to Khartoum. And they did it. They built this railway over the space. Being British, they started doing the work in the summer, which was pretty daft. But they built it. This man, Churchill, wrote a fantastic book about it called The Sudan War. Churchill, one of the beautiful things about writing books is you end up reading lots of other books, and one of the great pleasures was reading Churchill's books on what Churchill is an absolutely fantastic writer. And he writes very journalistically. He writes in a very kind of open, accessible style. And this is a rather obscure book, rather obscure war, but really worth reading. Available from Amazon, as everything is. And he basically wrote that once they built the railway, the war was won. They built this railway. They could deliver all their troops down to Khartoum, and they only lost about 15 people killed once they got there, because they were far better armed than the other lot, and all their arms could be carried on the railway and so on. So they actually, it was the railway which won it. The Boer War was a similar war in some respects, in that the railway was absolutely crucial in bringing troops down. The Boer War was really a war between the Dutch-speaking Boers who were in control of Transvaal and the Orange Free State and wanted more autonomy. The British didn't, who were occupied Natal and the Cape, didn't want to allow them to have that freedom, declared war stupidly. That's a lesson from this book, incidentally, that most of these wars were totally avoidable and usually those who launched them had cause to regret it. Virtually every case, actually. There were lots of use of armoured trucks, armoured trains. Churchill got captured on one of these, actually, in an ambush and nearly got killed. But fortunately, some private waved a white flag and prevented him from being killed, because otherwise history might have been very different. Or we might be speaking German in this seminar. The British gradually reclaimed territory through using the armoured trains as reconnaissance and sticking these bicycle things. I'm a cyclist, and that's why I like these pictures. And they had these cycles on rails that went ahead of the armoured trains to check for any mines or for enemy troops being there. And they thought this was such a good idea that they built one that was devised for 12 people, with 13 people, one person in the middle. Actually, it weighed over a ton when it was cycled along, and not very successful, but I just had it there as a nice joke, really. And really, they won it through building blockhouses like this. They built hundreds of these blockhouses along the railway, and gradually, as they reclaimed a bit of railway, they would build a blockhouse or a bit of road, they would reclaim it and keep the guerrillas, the Boer guerrillas out. The Russian-Japanese War is the only war in my history that was actually entirely caused by a railway. It was caused by the construction of the Trans-Siberian Railway, about which I'm going to write a book. It was built through Manchuria, and the Japanese didn't like that and decided to attack the Russians. The Russians had to bring in all their troops along the Trans-Siberian Railway, which was a big enterprise. It's 5,000 miles from Moscow to Vladivostok along a pretty ropey railway, and it took 30 days for the troops to get there. There was only three trains per day. The trains would be very break down quite a lot. It was there wasn't enough rolling stock and so on. And inevitably, because of that, the Japanese were able to get far more troops in the right places. The battles took place at Mukden and Harbin were the two main places the battles took place. The Japanese managed to win every conflict, every battle, completely wiped out the Russians, almost caused a revolution in 1905 in Russia, which was not successful, but nevertheless sowed the seeds of the communist revolution, and resulted in the fall of the Tsars. There was one bit across Lake Baikal, which is Asia's biggest lake, where they hadn't finished a railway, and they laid down tracks across the ice, which was a terrible bottleneck. And they tried to put locomotives on it, but inevitably the locomotives fell through the ice. And so the guys had to really pull and push and use a few horses to kind of drag all the supplies across across the lake, which is 30 miles long. So that again was one of the sort of reasons why the Russians were so much weaker than the Japanese. And I couldn't find any good photographs of the of the war, but I just got to what I found one that sort of shows the Japanese kind of attacking the trains, which is the best one I could find. Anyway, the First World War is impossible to actually exaggerate the significance of transport and the railways in the First World War. There's many books written about the First World War which almost completely omit the fact that the war was and that the way the war was conducted was actually entirely down to the level of transport technology, and in particular of trains. Now there is a myth about this war, which is the most famous bit that you know, almost anybody who often asks me about the book says, you know, is it true that the railway timetables caused the First World War? And the theory was, it was A.J.P. Taylor's theory, who's unfortunately no longer with us to challenge this, but A.J.P. Taylor argued that because once you started the trains rolling with all the troops on board, and you had to stick to a timetable, you couldn't stop the process. And I'm afraid that's utter bunk. What it's based on is the idea that the German Kaiser, at one point just before the war started, was hesitant about whether they should attack France first or whether they took attack the Russians first. They decided to attack France first. And in fact, they went through Luxembourg first. That was their absolute first bit of the war. There is absolutely no reason why the process could not have been stopped if they had wanted peace, but they didn't want peace. The war was kind of inevitable from the militarization of Germany over the previous 40 years. And they set down this plan called the Schlieffen Plan, which was based on the railways. And the whole idea was, and it's one of those really neat things, you know, you set down on a map and you say, well, we're going to get to Paris in 39 days. And they had a plan to get to Paris in 39 days. And they had to go through Belgium, which was neutral at the time. And you know, that was against all the existing treaties. But they completely ignored that. And it was based on the idea that Belgium wouldn't resist. In fact, Belgium did resist, blew up all its railways, actually fought against the Germans quite bravely and delayed the whole process. And the Schlieffen Plan was unsuccessful. But they had worked this plan out over the previous 15 years. And as you all know, the war ended in a stalemate. The initial battles ended in a stalemate that was to last 3.5 years, the Western Front. And the British and the French counter-attacked in the Battle of the Marne in September 1914, eventually fought their way up to the sea, and this front kind of established itself. And there the role of the railways is absolutely crucial. It was the railways that brought in all the troops. That is obvious. But it was also the railways that enabled both sides to be supplied. It wasn't only the sort of big railways like this. They built a series of smaller railways, which are 60 centimetre gauge railways. And these brought the troops the last 7 miles and the supply of the last 7 miles to the front, because sorry, 7 kilometres, because the range of the guns was such that they could attack anything 7 kilometres away. So, and it didn't matter whether you attacked these railways, because they were small enough to be relayed almost overnight. They were sort of called portable railways. In German, they were called Fieldenbahn, which is kind of field railways. Now, why one was built for a house like this, I've got no idea. I've given this lecture probably 25 times and nobody has given me a coherent explanation. I mean, it probably was that the barn was there before and they just put the railway through it. But why on earth they did that, I've got absolutely no idea. But these railways were used very intensely to supply the front and to supply and to avoid the hassle of people having to wade through the mud and all the very difficult conditions to get to the front. Road transport did exist, but it was very crude at the time. You know, it was lorries kind of might last for a day or two without being repaired, but then they'd have to be repaired very quickly. The roads were very poor. There were very few tarred roads, so most of the transportation was done by railways. And that was just a nice picture of King George the Fifth on one of these now petrol-driven little tractors. Railways were also used very intensely for taking troops out once they were injured. In fact, they would have these hospital trains ready and waiting to take people out once a battle started. And they were actually in the Battle of the Somme, which was the first day of which was the bloodiest day in British military history. They actually had people in these hospital trains back in London by the end of the first day, because they had ferries that the wagons went on, and they'd head to Charing Cross and where there was a hospital at the time, and actually take these people back within the same day as the battle started. On the Eastern Front, there were far fewer railways, and oddly, therefore, is a more mobile war. Eventually, it did settle down into a front, but there's a real contradiction there, that because you have fewer railways, you're actually more mobile. And that's because you don't have the railways to kind of feed a front in the same way that you could have on the Western Front. And there are two famous incidents in the First World War which also involved trains. Of course, Lenin being taken through the front in order to foment revolution in Russia. And successfully, because he actually the Germans allowed him through, so that he would then pull the Russians out of the war, which he actually did. And the other one was Lawrence of Arabia, kind of keeping half the Turkish army kind of active, protecting the Hejaz railway, which is now in Saudi Arabia, or the remnants of it is, because it doesn't work anymore. But that was, of course, another famous film, the Lawrence of Arabia film, which is all about that. Very quickly, because I'm conscious of time, the Russian Civil War was again another war on which it was largely fought on the Trans-Siberian Railway, because the Russians had the communists had taken over much of Western Russia, but it was the Eastern Russia. And there were a bunch of Czech troops as well who were fighting with the white Russians along the Trans-Siberian Railway. Armoured trains were by then very sophisticated and very heavily used, although not a pleasant weapon if you happened to be trapped and the train broke down and troops could come in and throw grenades and stuff. So this one particularly changed hands a few times as it was taken over by different sides. And, of course, we had the whole war being run from an armoured train. As you've seen, Dr. Zhivago, who recognised this as Tom Courtney in playing Strelnikov, who really is Trotsky running the war, with all his maps and everything from an armoured train, as gradually they kind of took over the country for, heading eastwards. World War II, amazingly enough, you'd have thought that by then they would have actually had more sophisticated transport, motorised transport, aviation, that railways would not play a role. But actually railways still played a role, were a vital part of the logistics. And we're still far more efficient at taking large amounts of war materiel to a war zone than any other method. This is Dunkirk, which one of the reasons why Hitler didn't manage to kind of wipe out the troops in Dunkirk quickly enough was he didn't have enough logistical support, and that was essentially railways. But the bit where the railways probably made the key difference to the war was on the Russian front. The Germans tried to invade Russia and suffered the same fate as Napoleon and everybody else who'd ever tried to invade Russia. Got bogged down. They couldn't get there quickly enough. The whole need was to invade by Christmas or by winter. They didn't manage to do that and got bogged down. There were three armies basically aimed at Leningrad, Moscow, and Stalingrad in the south. And each one of them, for one reason or another, got bogged down. Each one had one railway line behind them, but it wasn't enough. And really, that's where you know the war was actually won and lost. And one of the reasons was that one of the problems they had was that the Russians used a different gauge of railway. It was a 5-foot gauge instead of a 4-foot, 8.5 gauge. And so you had to move the rails as you moved eastwards. And at the point at which you changed the gauge, everything had to be unloaded and reloaded. And that actually caused a major difficulty and logistical problem. I couldn't write the book without mentioning the role of the railways in transporting the Jews to the concentration camps. And again, that was it shows the kind of advantage, I mean, in a sickening way, the advantage of railways, because they could never have transported that number of people on by road, just in terms of number of personnel, the number of troops you'd need, the number of trucks you would need. There was no way of doing it, and it was because of the railways that it made possible, and the railways' role in it is pretty shameful and indeed has been subsequently criticised. And then towards the end of the war, it was a matter of blowing up railways. So they blew up all the French railways. The Resistance blew up some of them, the RAF blew up some of the other, the American Air Force blew up the rest, and so much so that I've seen a map of the French railways before the invasion starts, and there's actually virtually nothing left. There's just a few little tiny bits of railway, but there is essentially no railway network left. And so the railways had to be rebuilt from the sea, basically. And one of the reasons for the delays and why it took so long for the Allies to reclaim France was because there were no railways to do it. And they tried trucks, and they tried something called the Red Ball Express in one area, and trucks just did not have the capacity that the railways did. They used far more people and far more equipment. And it wasn't until we destroyed the German railways, which had a lot of duplication in them, but it wasn't until the Allies finally realised that it was no good just bombing the factories, they had to bomb the railways. And that really was a change in policy towards the end of the bombing campaign and proved highly successful. And the last war I look at is the Korean War, which, again, you thought by the 1950s air power would be all important, but actually it wasn't. The Allies, which were the United Nations, which are mainly the Americans, but also the British and Australians, tried on numerous occasions to blow up the railways because they were supplying the North Koreans were being supplied from Manchuria by the railways. They tried to blow up the railways time and again and never really succeeded in doing it. And there's a rather plaintive kind of pamphlet written by Admiral von Fleet, who was the leader of the United Nations forces after the war, which I discovered in the depths of the Imperial War Museum Library, where he bemoans the fact that they try to blow up the railways all the time and they never managed to do it, because basically you can destroy the station, you can destroy other things, but as long as you've got the two tracks going, that's all you need. And it proved far more difficult to do than expected. Just a couple of conclusions. I hope I've shown to you something rather interesting. You look at history. I think there's a lot more research needs to be done in this area. If any of you are thinking of PhDs, I think there'd be a wonderful PhD to do on the role of the railways and war, and why actually their role has been so forgotten, as it is in much other history as well, that they played an absolutely vital role. But also just the way that railways changed the nature of warfare. They made them bloodier, they made wars longer, they made wars more intense, they allowed ammunition to be delivered and so on. And the nature of warfare changed, partly when the transportation system changed, when you got more efficient aircraft so you could actually target things much better. We see now how one tank can be blown up by a missile, which in those in the period I've covered couldn't be. And that changed the nature of warfare. You no longer have kind of mass scale warfare of kind of thousands of troops on both sides kind of attacking each other, because you can't, because of the technology has changed. But for the 100-year period that I cover in my book, we had the bloodiest ever wars. Contrast the way one soldier killed in Afghanistan is news now with 16,000 soldiers killed on the first day of the Battle of Somme, was barely news. So the railways changed the nature of wars, and for a period were absolutely vital to the way warfare was conducted. So thank you very much.